Good morning and welcome to the Jobs Conference Committee. I call this meeting to order. This is a remote hearing. This remote hearing can be viewed via the House webcast. I know we just wanted to make sure that we note who is in attendance of the Conference Committee. Mr. Rees, if you can call the members and senators who are in attendance.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Hamilton.
Present.
Senator Pratt.
Here.
Senator Rarick.
Present.
Senator Dreheim.
Present.
Senator Housley. Senator Eakin. He is present but unmuted at the moment. Looks like we're waiting on Senator Housley.
Hi, Travis.
Thank you, Senator Eakin. Yeah, it looks like we're waiting on Senator Housley. I'll note when she arrives in the Zoom.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rees. So today, members and senators, we will go over the spreadsheet. And we will also have testimony from the commissioners. So without any further delay, I just wanted to ask if there's any question, Chair Pratt or any senator or members. I know the Senate has got also other schedules, so we will try our best to make sure that we include everyone in the conversation. I would like to start with the spreadsheet, Ms. Beckel, Sylvia Beckel, if you can begin and share with us the screen and we can go over the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair and members, Sylvia Beckel, House Fiscal Analysis. I will share my screen now. Okay. Looking at this spreadsheet, this first page here is a summary of general fund spending. So here's spending, here's revenue, and then this line here is the total general fund impact. I'm just going to be going over the change provisions from base in the House proposal. Starting with the revenue, the House has the paid family and medical leave general fund transfer in. I'll explain more about that later, but this is effectively paying back the general fund for expenses incurred in fiscal year 2022. The next item is the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund. The Northeast Entrepreneur Fund will pay back the state in fiscal year 21, and then it will get an exact same amount paid back to it in fiscal year 21. This is just to extend the appropriation. This is the Minnesota Investment Fund one-time extension. You can see that this line is aqua. That is to indicate that it is both a House and Senate provision. Then there is an earned sick and safe time revenue item. $311,000 in the first biennium, $414,000 in the second biennium. And then this item here, it has a asterisk G next to it. This is the governor's proposal for the small business loan repayment plan. So because the governor has loans instead of grants, as the House position has, which you will see later in this spreadsheet, the governor had revenue. Of course, you can see here that I am only showing the House and Senate position. This is not a full spreadsheet. You can see my full spreadsheet, our full spreadsheet, on the relevant committee pages, but this is just in an effort to make it a bit more visible for the public. Otherwise, the numbers get pretty small. Okay. Moving down, we see the Workforce Development Fund impact and the Workers' Compensation Fund impact. You'll note here that the House and Senate are fairly different. Senate, House, and I'll explain that later. OK, Okay, getting into the detail, this is the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The first change item here is the House provision for moving the Labor Market Information Office to Business and Community Development. Deed told us that the office had moved and therefore they were asking for the operating funding to move as well. The governor then also has a proposal for, a proposal for the Small Business Development Center for regional support, and the House has included that provision. The governor also has a larger small business support package of $3 million each year, and the House has that position as well. The governor and the House have a provision for local community child care. The House funded this at $10 million in the first year. The House has a Child Care Minnesota Initiative Foundation's funding as well for $2 million in the first year. The House also follows the governor's lead of reducing the appropriation. You can see it's a million less over the biennium, as the governor suggested, in order to be economical with funds. The Minnesota Investment Fund, the House has also taken the governor's recommendation to reduce the funding to that. As you can see in the tails, these funds are returned to their normal level of funding. Then the House has a provision to allow the Duluth Paper Mill to extend their use of Minnesota investment funds, and it was a $2 million appropriation. Now it is increased to a $3 million appropriation, and this is just a carve-out from the Minnesota Investment Fund. Moving down, the governor had a recommendation for automation training incentive programs for employers. The House has taken that provision for $500,000, over the biennium. The governor also recommended continuing the Launch Minnesota program, and so that was funded by the House as well. The Micro Enterprise Development Program is a provision only in the House bill for $2.1 million over the biennium. The House also has community business development grants, in these amounts just for the first year, just for the first biennium. Here you can see the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund receiving the appropriation in fiscal year 21. And here is the House's proposal for the $50 million in small business support that would go out in fiscal year 21, and these are grants. The House, again, was asked to move the Labor Market Information Office from one area of deed to another, so this is just showing that change. And this was also a governor's recommendation that the House took. Again, this was moved to business and community development. And finally, the House has a provision allowing the Hmong Chamber of Commerce to use $125,000 of their previous appropriation in the 22-23 biennium. Moving down, the governor had a proposal to eliminate the higher ed career advising program in order to divert funds to what they believed was a more effective use. So the House has taken this proposal and reallocated that funding. The governor and the House both supported Propel nonprofits. The House has funded that at $2 million in the first biennium. The Minnesota Technical Association is being funded at $1.75 million over the biennium. And the ProStart Hospitality is being funded at $250,000 over the biennium in the first year. And notably, these are general fund appropriations. Later, we will see Senate appropriations for some of these items. But those will be in the Workforce Development Fund. Okay. For the general support services, the House went with the governor's recommendation for an operating increase. Here are the labor market information items being moved around to the Business and Community Development Office. The governor proposed state trade and export promotion grants of a lesser amount this year because they did not feel that they could be used. So that was a decrease for this year. As you can see, it goes back to normal levels of funding in the second biennium. And then the governor also proposed eliminating the Trade Policy Advisory Council. And so the House has gone with that position as well. All parties have gone with the administrative holdback, canceling that amount for savings of $1.022 million in fiscal year 21. And here, the House has the position of canceling the $25 million that was put toward the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Unfortunately, this is just not how the trust fund is paid back, and because these funds are not able to be used in this way, the House is canceling them. And that was from the December special session. Now we've come down to the paid family and medical leave provision. This is a large item in the House proposal. They have general fund appropriations of $10.828 million in the first year. Then there is the creation of the paid family and medical leave account. And so then there are appropriations in the second year and in the tails. Moving down, the Destination Medical Center is a statutory appropriation, and they are receiving $58.954 million over the first biennium, and $73.955 over the second biennium. Moving down to the Department of Labor and Industry, the House has a career pathway demonstration program. You'll see this in the Senate as well. It's just that this item in the House is funded via the general fund. Then the House has provisions for nursing and lactating mothers leave modification. That is $118,000 in the first biennium and $68,000 in the second biennium. Earned sick and safe time enforcement and earned sick and safe time grants for $3.247 million and $600,000 respectively over the biennium. Rehire and retention protections, which is $158,000 in the first biennium. And then a safe workplaces provision, meat and poultry processing, for $491,000 in the first biennium and $294,000 in the second biennium. Next, the House has a provision for helmets to hard hats. The numbers are slightly different, as you can see, but both the House and Senate has this provision as well. The governor recommended an OSHA operating adjustment. The House went with this position, so that's an increase of 1.806 over each biennium. And the House also decided to go with the federal penalty conformance language, which has revenues to the workers' compensation fund for those increased penalties. Then the House has dual training and competency grants. This is just a transfer from the Office of Higher Education. So this level of funding was just over at the Office of Higher Education, and it's being moved to the House, or it's being moved to the Department of Labor and Industry. Here we have the Senate Career Pathway here we have the House Career Pathway Demonstration Program. Earlier I referenced the Senate one. Moving down, the House has commercial energy code improvements, which come in at $145,000 in the second year. They also went with construction code fee reductions just for this biennium. And that comes in at $4.5 million a year or over the biennium. And then the House also included a contractor recovery fund modification, which results in $492,000 from the contractor recovery fund. Here is the paid family and medical leave provision in the Department of Labor and Industry. There is $528,000 in the first year from the general fund, and then there are funds in the second year and in the tails from the paid family and medical leave fund. The House went with an operating increase for the Bureau of Mediation Services, so an increase of $205,000 over the biennium. The House also went with an increase to the Public Employee Relations Board, so an increase of $870,000 over the biennium. Here's the administrative holdback for the Department of Labor and Industry that all parties went with. The IRRR has statutory funding. Please excuse these numbers. This is an error. And they received $5.168 million in the first biennium and $5.65 million over the second. And again, this is just statutory funding. Moving down, the Department of Human Services receives funds for implementation of the paid family and medical leave program as well. There is an appropriation in the HHS bill that relates to paid family and medical leave as well. And that would be in fiscal year 25. The Minnesota Management and Budget also incurs costs for earned sick and safe time, $3,000 in the first year for printing. Then they also incur costs of the paid family and medical leave fund, and that's $23,000 in the second year and $13,000 each year in the tails. In order to update the payroll system, the House receives $11,000 for the implementation of paid family and medical leave. The Supreme Court receives $20,000 in the first year. The Court of Appeals receives $5.6 million in fiscal year 25 for the implementation of paid family and medical leave. And I believe that's all of paid family and medical leave. And then the Attorney General receives an appropriation of $222,000 each year for the implementation of the Safe Workplaces Meat and Poultry Processing. And with that, that concludes my run through of the spreadsheet. I will turn this over to my Senate counterpart, Mr. Mum.
Thank you so much, Ms. Bickle. I know that I see a question. Members, if you have any question, use the raise hand function. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, and we can wait until they walk through the second spreadsheet if from the Senate, and then I can ask my question.
All right, that works for me. Mr. Mum, welcome, and please proceed with the presentation of the spreadsheet from the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I will share my screen as well. It will be the same spreadsheet that Ms. Beckle just walked us through, only I will be highlighting the Senate change items. So I'll go ahead and share my screen. Is this visible to everyone?
It is visible to me.
Excellent. Okay. Well, just starting from the top, the first item that is a Senate change item is on line 20, which is also a House change item. This is the revenue estimated from the one-time exception to the Minnesota Investment Fund requirements that Ms. Beckle explained. Counts $595,000 of revenue in fiscal year 22. Moving down to page two, The first Senate change item is on line 61. This is a $3 million appropriation for through the Minnesota Initiative Foundations for a childcare grants. This was funded in the current biennium at a lower amount.
We don't have the page two. It's still stuck on page one. If you can go to the presentation view.
Oh, okay.
All right, now we have page two.
Page two, excellent. Okay, I apologize for that. Line 61 was where I was pointing out that the Senate bill contains a $3 million one-time appropriation in fiscal year 22 for child care grants through the Minnesota Initiative Foundations. Below that on line 62 is a $200,000 one-time appropriation for a child care center in Mount Vernon. On line 66, this provision was also carried in the Senate bill, even though there is not a number shown here. That is, we carried the same provision that is in the House bill, increasing the amount of the MIF appropriation for the Verso paper mill in Duluth and making some modifications to that appropriation. On line 80, there is a $100 million appropriation to the Small Business Loan Guarantee Program. This is a one-time appropriation from the general fund in fiscal year 22. And this is for the loan guarantee program that I believe either Ms. Doyle Fontaine or Ms. Shalene pointed out in the walkthrough of the policy articles. It's on page R49 of the economic development policy article, if I'd like to look further into that. On page three, line 84, there's a $1 million one-time appropriation for the Airport Infrastructure Renewal Program. This was funded in the current biennium as well. And this is, again, just another one-time appropriation. On lines 100 and 101 are two appropriations from the workforce, direct appropriations from the Workforce Development Fund, both one-time. One is for $1.5 million for the Neighborhood Development Center, and one is for $500,000 for Youth Prize. And both of these appropriations were made in the current biennium as well. On line 122 is a special revenue fund change item. This would actually be a decrease in revenue resulting from extending the job creation goals for some Minnesota Investment Fund loan recipients. Without this extension, those loans would be required to be repaid. And so this amount represents the foregone revenue from those repayments enabled by allowing the goal deadlines to be extended. Moving on to page four, beginning on line 151 and going through line 174, you'll see a number of direct appropriations from the Workforce Development Fund. These are all of the change items are one-time appropriations in the Senate bill. On line 151 is for the American Indian Community, OIC. On line 157 is the Goodwill Easter Seals Father Project. That's a $1 million appropriation. $600,000 is for the International Institute. $1.5 million is for the Boys and Girls Clubs. On line 160 is a $300,000 appropriation to the Minnesota Grocers Association's Carts to Careers program. There's a $250,000 appropriation for ProStart. This is a provision that is also funded in the House bill from the general fund, so the funding will appear on different lines. There is a $500,000 $500,000 appropriation for Clues. $1.4 million appropriation for Twin Cities Rise, $1.75 million appropriation for the Minnesota Technical Association SciTech Experience Internship Program. This is another provision that was funded in the House bill through from the general fund. So it again, it appears on different lines. The House appropriations on line 138. The Bridges to Healthcare program is funded at $600,000. Avivo has an appropriation of $800,000. The Hmong American Partnership is funded at $600,000. The Hmong Chamber of Commerce is funded at $250,000. I'd note that this is in addition to what the House provision is that allows the fiscal year 2021 appropriation to be made available through the end of the upcoming biennium. $426,000 is for the Minnesota Resiliency Partnership. That's a program run by DEED that was formerly known as this Displaced Homemaker Program. $2 million is for Summit Academy OIC. $500,000 is for Big Brothers, Big Sisters of the Twin Cities. $1 million is for Ujamaa Place, and $300,000 is for the YWCA of St. Paul. Moving on to page five, there's just a single change here in the Senate position, and that's on line 230. It's also a change that was carried in the House bill and proposed by the governor. It cancels just a little over $1 million of the administrative holdback identified by the administration in ahead of the November forecast. So cancels that amount, which shows up as a reduction in spending. Moving on to page six, on line 270 is another administrative holdback cancellation for the Department of Labor and Industry. This again was carried by the House and was proposed in the governor's budget, canceling $203,000 of administrative holdback. On line 283 is the Career Pathways Demonstration Program. This is a career demonstration program with the 49ers. And this is in both the House and the Senate bills, as Ms. Solvay pointed out. The Senate funds it from the general fund at $100,000 in fiscal year 22. Moving on to page seven, on line 294 is the appropriation that both House and Senate are carrying for the Helmets to Hard Hats program. It's a workforce development fund appropriation of $400,000. The same amount was appropriated in the current biennium. On 299 is, this is actually not an appropriation, but it's extending the workers' compensation fund appropriation for the workers' compensation IT system that was made in the current biennium. It's extending the availability of those funds through the upcoming biennium, which is scored as a cost of $700,000 in fiscal 22. That's the estimated amount of the appropriation that's left that would otherwise cancel at the end of the current biennium. Moving on to page eight, on line 347 is change the Bureau of Mediation Services. The Senate position does not provide funding for the Public Employee Relations Board. That shows as a change of negative $250,000 in both the upcoming biennium and the fiscal 24-25 planning period. On line 351 is a cancellation of the fiscal year 21 administrative holdback. Again, provision carried in the House bill and proposed by the governor. Moving on to line or the final page, line 389. This is a $20.55 million appropriation in fiscal year 20 to the Department of Revenue to issue direct payments to businesses. And the appropriation rider specifies that the payments must be made to businesses that would have received a payment under the December special session bill appropriation, But we're not able to due to a characterization miscategorization of the business according to their NAICS codes. There on line 392, there is a $20.65 million cancellation of that amount from the December special session bill. This is the amount that already actually canceled on March 15th of this year of that $88 million appropriation. But the Senate bill includes language to effectuate that cancellation, which is a method that MMB has advised us will allow that cancellation to be tracked, and we can count it as a reduction in spending compared to the forecast because the cancellation occurred after the February forecast was published. So if you then go back up way to the beginning at page one, you can see the summary of those changes. On line 15, it shows the total general fund spending in the Senate position. In the current biennium, it's a reduction of $1.427 million. In the upcoming biennium, it's an increase of $1.02 million. With the $595,000 of revenue estimated from the Minnesota Investment Fund one-time exception provision, that brings the net change for fiscal year 22-23 to $101,427,000. The net effect with the combined fiscal year 2021 reductions is $100 million over the base general fund appropriations. So, Mr. Chair and members, that concludes the walkthrough of the Senate change provisions in the appropriations article.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mums, and also Ms. Beckel. Members and senators, if you have any question, I'm assuming Representative Olson, your question was answered through the presentation. Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Beckel, if you could one more time pull up the dollars amount or just address the dollars that are allocated for the enforcement action for the new programs that are established in the House bill. I missed that provision for the paid family medical leave, wage theft record keeping, and what's the other one? The earned safe and sick time. So just the enforcement dollars that are needed to enforce those new mandates or programs. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lead Hamilton. We will also have the commissioner. So in case you wanted to ask those questions through the commissioner, that would be great. Ms. Beckel, if you can just bring up the spreadsheet and show those sections.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hamilton. So I will just go down to those provisions once more. I have them split out into the different agencies, so they are in a few different places. So here is the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So the general fund spending for DEED in the first year is largely for IT build, and then the paid family and medical leave fund has appropriations for outreach and education. So these items are not so much for enforcement, but the commissioner can definitely go through that in more detail. Moving down to the Department of Labor and Industry. Here is their paid family and medical leave. Here we see some oversight and compliance funds. So that's $528,000 in the first year from the general fund, $518,000 in the second year from the new family medical benefit fund, and then continuing costs of $468,000 in fiscal year 24 and $618,000 in fiscal year 2025. moving down to the Department of Human Services. These are largely for systems modifications. Let's see, and then Minnesota Management and Budget. This is not so much enforcement here, but payroll system upgrades again, and then employer paid premium costs. So for the employees of the state, so that comes in at $1.9 million the second year, and then ongoing it would be roughly $3.7 million each year for those costs. And there's earned sick and safe time, of course, but that is also not for enforcement. Payroll system update for the House, payroll or update to the case management system for the Supreme Court. So then, and the Court of Appeals then has denied benefit claim appeals starting in fiscal year 25. But let me go back up now to address the earned sick and safe time question. Apologies. Okay, here we are. So for earned sick and safe time enforcement, there are costs of $1.3 million in the first year, $1.9 million in the second year, and then ongoing costs of $1.6 roughly million each year after that for earned sick and safe time enforcement. And then wage theft is wage theft is an existing provision, and so the House position just funds that at levels it was previously funded at in the base. So let me find that. Yes, the Wage Theft Prevention Initiative. So that has roughly $2 million each year, and that is in the base. And I hope I've caught everything, but I apologize if I have not. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Beckel. Lead Hamilton, did you, you want to have a follow-up?
I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the information.
All right. Any further questions before we move into the second part of the presentation this morning? Chair Eklund, if you may proceed with the Commissioner for Department of Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I take my camera off because in International Falls we have poor bandwidth. So if you guys don't see me, that doesn't mean I'm not sitting here listening. So I'll put it on for right now. Commissioner Robertson, would you are you ready to present for the conference committee? Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, I'm ready to begin.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Conference Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Rosalyn Robertson. I am the Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I appreciate the efforts of legislators have put into developing your respective jobs and labor omnibus bills, and I'm pleased to participate in the conference committee process. I'd like to begin my remarks today by highlighting agency priorities that have been included in both the House and the Senate. First, I'd like to thank the House and Senate for including a proposal to extend funds from a prior appropriation for the Workers' Compensation Program, Work Comp Campus. This funding will enable continued improvements to the campus information technology system, which will benefit the many workers' compensation stakeholders who interact with the system to provide accurate and timely benefits to injured workers. the legislature appropriated $3 million in fiscal year 2020 for workers' compensation campus, but the authority to expend those dollars is set to expire June 30th, 2021. This proposal will extend authority to spend the money, an estimated $700,000 through fiscal 23. Second, I appreciate the Senate included Senator Coleman's bill and the House included its companion, Representative Cagle's bill, also a governor proposal to extend rights to pregnancy and nursing accommodations in the workplace. These proposals aim to support expectant and new moms so they can safely work during their pregnancy and take break time needed to express breast milk at work without losing pay and without risking losing their jobs. In addition to supporting working parents, these proposed changes will also benefit employees through employee retention, loyalty, productivity, and lower turnover. The agency prefers the stronger workplace protection in the House version of the legislation, along with $118,000 in funding the House includes for outreach and compliance activities. I encourage the conference committee to adopt the House position on nursing mothers, lactating employees, and pregnancy conditions. Third, I'm appreciative that the House and Senate include the agency policy proposal to bring Minnesota apprenticeship program into conformity with federal equal employment opportunity in employment provisions and support employers' efforts to build a more diverse and skilled workforce. Also to protect minors' personal data in child labor matters and adding an energy and accessibility technical expert to the Construction Code Advisory Council to better advise the commissioner about proposed changes to the Construction Code. I was pleased to work with Senator Rarick to address concerns that he had that members of the Construction Code Advisory Council had expertise in the industry they represent. As such, DLI supports the Senate position on changes to the Construction Code Advisory Council membership. The agency proposal to make OSHA citations public, which would improve transparency and workplace safety, however, was included only in the House omnibus. The agency has worked with Senator Rarick and stakeholders to find a compromise that would make citation data public 20 days after the employer received the citation. The compromise should be included in the final bill. I'd next like to comment on the House inclusion of many of the governor's budget recommendations for the department. I am grateful these provisions have been included in the House bill as they support our economic recovery, improve worker protection, and enable the agency to better meet the needs of the Minnesota we serve. First, I'm appreciative that the House includes requested operating increases for the labor standards, apprenticeship, and MnOSHA programs. I'll note that both the Senate and House bill include an agency recommendation to reduce $203,000 from DLI General Fund operating appropriation in fiscal 21. This amount reflects the savings generated due to the state hiring freeze and other operating efficiencies in the current fiscal year. The House bill however, includes $152,000 operating adjustment in fiscal 22 and 23 to address increasing cost pressures and enable the Labor Standards Division to continue to provide employer support about labor law compliance and provide employees information about their rights in the workplace. This funding will enable the division to continue education and outreach activities, as well as respond to employee complaints and investigate allegations of violations at current service levels. I encourage the adoption of this increase. The House includes a $138,000 annual increase to the apprenticeship operating budget to fund an additional FTE to continue expanded program activity and strategies to grow the registered apprenticeship program. This position, currently funded by an expiring federal grant, is critical to Apprenticeship Minnesota's role as a meaningful connector to drive greater participation and inclusion in registered apprenticeship. The funding will mean additional support for employers seeking to develop a skilled and diverse workforce. It also supports Joint Apprenticeship Committees who have indicated their need, their desire, and commitment to diversify registered apprenticeship. I strongly urge inclusion of this proposal in the funding. Next, the House bill includes $1.806 million in fiscal 22 and 23 for an operating increase for Minnesota OSHA to increase the number of safety and health investigators. This funding will help ensure Minnesota OSHA can promptly address workplace safety and health concerns and prevent workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. The increase would fund an additional 9.5 full-time equivalents to maintain a state program as effective as federal OSHA. This is a request to maintain current services and to add additional staff to handle the increase in stakeholders' inquiries, complaints, and requests for assistance. Minnesota OSHA has seen a considerable decline in FTEs from 75 positions in 2012 to 62 positions in 2020, putting the program at risk at losing its as effective as status and hindering MnOSHA's ability to effectively meet its statutory obligation. Increasing the number of safety and health investigators will enable Minnesota OSHA to maintain its mission to protect workers at private and public work sites in Minnesota and prevent workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. This provision should be adopted. I'd also like to extend my support for the House position on Earn Sick and Safe Time, Representative Olson's legislation. This proposal ensures workers can accrue up to 48 hours per year of paid leave to take time off work to recover from an illness, go to a medical appointment, care for a child during a school closure, or get care and assistance due to domestic abuse, stalking, or sexual assault. Working Minnesotans need paid time off to care for themselves and or a loved one when they get sick. In 2016, over 900,000 working Minnesotans did not have job protected paid time off. nearly one-third of working people in the state. Many workers can't afford to take unpaid time off work to care for themselves or a sick child and may feel forced to go into work even when sick, putting customers and coworkers at risk of also falling ill. The COVID pandemic has demonstrated now more than ever Minnesotans need paid time off. The conference committee should adopt this provision and the related funding. The agency also supports inclusion of paid family and medical leave in the House Omnibus. A comprehensive paid family and medical leave program will provide Minnesotans economic stability and needed time away from work to welcome a new family member, care for an aging loved one, or recover from an illness or injury. Current unpaid leave laws, which provide a right for certain employees to take protected leave, depending on the size of the employer and how long they've been employed, are woefully inadequate as many workers simply cannot afford to take extended unpaid time off for caring responsibilities. Paid family and medical leave would ease the financial burden on families during significant life events. In addition to partial wage replacement, the legislation includes important job protections to ensure workers can return to employment after a leave and can't be retaliated against for requesting or obtaining benefits. Paid family and medical leave would also benefit employers, increasing workforce attachment and employee morale. I appreciate that the House bill provides $1.046 million in fiscal year 22-23 for the Department of Labor and Industry to fund oversight and compliance costs related to the program, as well as IT systems upgrades. Minnesotans should be able to work and still take care of their families. I urge the conference committee to adopt this important proposal. I also note that the agency support for the emergency paid sick leave provision in the House, this bill leaves supports healthcare providers and other essential workers who may have exhausted their accrued time off due to the multiple quarantines during this pandemic. Access to emergency paid sick leave will improve economic security for these workers and positively impact public health. The agency also supports the House proposal to require contractors to participate in registered apprenticeship for work in construction and maintenance of all refineries, as it will ensure workers have access to the skills and training needed to perform the job safely. I urge the adoption of both of these proposals. I also appreciate the House bill directly appropriates $400,000 in dual training pipeline to DLI instead of continuing a transfer from the Office of Higher Education. This proposal will help to streamline government operations. Pipeline exists to support employers in creating or enhancing a competency-based dual training approach where workers receive a combination of related instructions strategically paired with on-the-job training. Regarding various provisions related to construction code and licensing, I appreciate the House inclusion of a proposal to put Minnesotans on track to achieve net zero energy use in new commercial and multifamily buildings by 2036. This proposal is a recommendation of the Climate Subcabinet and is a result of stakeholder work group convened by DLI and Commerce in the fall of 2019 and spring of 2020. Minnesota is on track to meet its greenhouse gas, is not on track to meet its greenhouse gas reduction goal, improving energy efficiency in commercial and large multifamily buildings is a key component to help the state get back on track as greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15% since 2005. The agency is in the process of rulemaking to adopt the latest model commercial energy standard, ASRAE 90.1-2019. Because the model code alone would be insufficient to achieve net zero energy use by 2036, the legislation require additional of a minimum 8% efficiency to the next ASRAE 90.1-2022. The subsequent codes, in order to meet the net zero goal, I encourage the conference committee to adopt this policy change and the $145,000 appropriation for rulemaking and a market and cost analysis. Next, the agency encourages the conference committee to adopt a House provision to extend fee reductions for licenses, building permits, and plan review services that will save the construction industry $4.5 million in fiscal 22 and 23. These fee reductions were enacted into law in 2015 and extended in 2017 and include license fees for construction contractors, electricians, plumbers, high pressure pipe fitters, and boiler operators, as well as building permit and plan review fees. Extending the fee reduction will allow individuals and business licensees to continue paying less while the agency continued to provide sufficient services. By maintaining this fee reduction, the agency will continue to have sufficient revenues for the department to cover program costs. The proposed extension is for 2 years to determine how the economic recovery is impacting the construction industry. Extending the fee reduction would result in a revenue decrease of approximately $2.25 million in fiscal year 22 and 23. The Construction Code Licensing Division has sought to keep its fees in line with the actual cost of providing the services for which the fees are paid. Construction code and licensing revenue is highly dependent on the health of the construction industry. If the construction industry slows considerably, the revenues from the reduced fees might not be sufficient to sustain the vital services. Therefore, we are asking that the proposal to extend the fee reductions for 2 years, and then we will reassess whether another extension is warranted at that time. We strongly encourage that the proposal be included. Next, I appreciate the House bill includes a consumer protection provision to increase the frequency of payouts from the Construction Recovery Fund and the amount of the funds available, as it will better protect homeowners who have suffered a financial loss due to a licensed contractor, fraudulent, deceptive, dishonest, or incomplete work. The legislation would increase the frequency of the contractor recovery payout and the amount of funds available to homeowners who have suffered a financial loss due to a licensed contractor's behavior. The proposal is to raise the maximum payout limit per licensed residential building contractor or the licensee from $300,000 to $800,000, thus minimizing the chance that a homeowner's claim would have to be prorated. The increased cap will result in an estimated 246,000 additional payouts per year to impacted homeowners. The current language, which limits the payout to once a year, unnecessarily prolongs a homeowner's recovery. If an owner misses a June deadline and applies in July, they would not receive compensation from the contracted recovery fund for almost a year and a half. Changing the payout and application deadlines to occur within the same fiscal year will also result in a more straightforward way to manage the fund. There are times when claims by multiple owners and lessees against a single contractor exceed the cap. In these instances, the commissioner must prorate the claim, resulting in them receiving far less than the amount of out-of-pocket loss. Increasing the maximum payout per licensee will allow for more homeowners to more closely recover their out-of-pocket loss when a licensee failed to perform their contractual obligations. The conference committee should adopt this proposal. The agency also supports and appreciates the House inclusion of an agency proposal to keep Minnesota OSHA penalties in line with federal OSHA for employers that fail to provide safety and healthy workplaces for their employees. This conformity will ensure continued federal funding and will encourage employers to take workplace safety and health violations more seriously. The provision would raise the maximum penalty for repeat, willful, serious, non-serious, and failure to correct and posting violations of workplace safety standards to conform with the federal law. It also would tie future penalties to the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers, or the CPIU. The increase in total penalties will vary from year to year, but on average, the change represents a 2% in overall penalties. This proposal will make the state penalty maximum comparable to federal and other state program penalty maximums. If Minnesota does not make the change, it may lose federal OSHA funding. Losing federal funding would result in the state forfeiting OSHA administration back to the federal Department of Labor. Then the higher federal penalties would go into effect without the mitigating factors that Minnesota OSHA applies when assessing penalties. This change would also result in a 750,000 state and local government employees not having OSHA coverage if the program was returned to federal OSHA. Labor and industry objects to a proposal in the House Omnibus Bill that cut funding for the agency information technology modernization project by $848,000. Without this funding, DLI will be unable to fully modernize software applications that began running out of vendor support this past January. which will decrease the transparency and increase transaction time for stakeholders interacting with the agency. We encourage the conference committee to adopt the Senate position to maintain this critical information technology funding. The agency has some concerns, specifically a number of provisions that appear in the Senate version of the omnibus bill and request they not be included in the final bill. First, the agency objects to the provision that requires the commissioner to issue a written warning to an employer upon first finding a workplace safety and health violation determined not to be of a serious nature. This provision violates our federal grant agreement because Minnesota OSHA would not be as effective as federal OSHA if we accepted that provision. Further, Minnesota OSHA uses its penalty authority to support compliance and keep workers safe. Limiting Minnesota OSHA authority would conflict with the grant agreement to be at least as effective as federal OSHA. Next, the Senate bill includes a provision that allows certain border cities to adopt cross-footing depths for one and two family dwelling that differ from the state building code. DLI is responsible for providing a building code that is uniform throughout the state of Minnesota to ensure consistent enforcement and a level playing field. Proposals to change the building code should be evaluated by the Construction Code and Advisory Council. This language should not be adopted at this time. Finally, the agency has concerns with some of the proposed changes to the wage theft law in the Senate omnibus, including employee notification requirements and penalties for willful violations of the notice requirement and failure to pay employees. While some of the provisions in the bill are clarifications of how the agency has been interpreting current law and are acceptable, others we object to as they undermine the purpose of the wage theft law to better inform workers of the conditions of their employment, prevent wage theft, and ensure workers are paid the wages they have earned. That concludes my prepared testimony. Thank you very much for the time. I am available to respond to questions. I also have invited a couple senior members of my staff. And if there are questions, I ask that those my staff be allowed to participate in this process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. And there are a few member questions. I remind members to use the raise hand function if it works. I know it doesn't always work in everybody's setup, so I have a list started. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Robertson, for your testimony. That was helpful to hear. I was just curious, you touched on it a little bit, and I appreciate it, and it also came up in questions on the spreadsheet. But regarding the Earn Sick and Safe Time legislation, would you be willing just to share a little bit about the department's plan for outreach and education to employers regarding those provisions and what the funding that we have proposed in the House bill would be used for? Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner Robertson.
Absolutely. That's an excellent question, Representative, and I am very happy to discuss it. This outreach and education is a cornerstone of how the Department of Labor and Industry work. It needs to be clear that at every possible juncture where the department can provide outreach and education, we rely on that model to clearly educate employers. The department would use the time prior to full implementation to develop training and outreach materials for employers. Once the materials and training is developed, we would make our staff available to give presentations to employers, employer associations, HR associations and software companies, all organizations that have the opportunity to reach a broader audience. We would look to connect with those entities. Similar to other laws under DLI's jurisdiction, the agency website would be updated to reflect the new law. We would assess whether or not we need to make that information available in other languages, and if so, we would have the information translated to provide to our limited English-speaking communities. We understand that ultimately compliance requires understanding, and we take our role in educating employers very seriously, and we would make every effort to educate employers before the law becomes effective, so that employers would have the best opportunity based on good, clear guidance and information in order for them to implement the requirements of the law.
Representative Olson.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Thanks, Mr. Chair and Commissioner.
Next on the list is Senator Hawsley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Robertson. I have a question, if you could help to go through the differences in Articles 2 and Articles 8 in the jobs, labor, industry section, the nursing, lactating mothers language. Could you explain the difference in the two bills between the House and the Senate?
Commissioner Robertson.
I will give it my best. First, I have to get to that section of the bill to just take a look at it. Can you give me 1 second, please? Or if I have a staff member on the line that can get to it quicker than me.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Housley, we have asked the two authors to get together and see if they can figure out the differences in the bills while the commissioner is looking for this, just for your information. So if we can.
If we can come back to that just shortly, give me just a second, Chairman.
Commissioner and Mr. Chair, I am available if you would like.
Thank you. Can you take that, Kate?
Commissioner Prushek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kate Prushek. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for that question, Senator Housley. For the nursing mothers provisions, both the House and the Senate do not have an employer, to reduce an employee's compensation for the break time used to express breast milk. So that is one significant change that's identical in both bills. The House version is slightly different in that it includes what I would call gender neutral language as one part, and then it also removes references to a woman's right to pump for her infant child. And the intent of that language is to allow surrogates or a bereaved parent who has lost a child to still take that break time to express breast milk and then donate that milk to another child in need. So those are the primary differences with the nursing mother's language. And then for pregnancy accommodations, both the House and the Senate, all that language is existing law that you see. It's simply moved from the pregnancy and parental leave statute to the nursing mother's statute so that different definitions apply. Namely, current law requires employers with 21 or more employees to provide a reasonable accommodation to a pregnant woman if she so requests. such as limits to heavy lifting, more frequent food and water breaks, and seating. And so the Senate position applies this workplace accommodation to employers with 15 or more employees, while the House drops it to one or more employees. And that employer standard is pretty, it's relatively common. I think there are 7 other states that apply pregnancy accommodations to employers with one or more employees, including North Dakota and Illinois are a couple. And then I would say the final major changes is the House includes funding for the department to engage in some of that outreach work that the commissioner just described. And then the effective dates are different. The House bill does not include an effective date. Since there's an appropriation, it would be effective July 1. And the Senate delays the effective date for a year following final enactment.
Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Question for either the Commissioner or Assistant Commissioner. The agency often in these committee hearings or in our phone conversations likes to say that the agency is the and between the labor and industry. I'm just curious, in this language, in the lactating mothers, did anybody consult the industry?
Commissioner Robertson or Assistant Commissioner Prusak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is Senator Coleman engaged with the Chamber of Commerce, and I know the National Federation of Independent Business testified in committee with some concerns.
Thank you.
Senator Housley?
Oh, that's good, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Well, it was my fault, Senator. I forgot to unmute myself, so I apologize. So, all right, next question is Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a follow-up to Senator Housley's question and Commissioner Prusak. If you could just explain a little bit of why you support the House language, that would be great. Thank you.
Commissioner Robertson or Assistant Commissioner Prusak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Berg. So as I mentioned to Senator Housley, the employer size in the pregnancy accommodations is reduced to one or more employees on the House side, while it's 15 or more employees on the Senate side. And we just really feel that these are common sense, reasonable accommodations. And when you think about it, a woman is only pregnant for 9 months and may not need an accommodation until later in her pregnancy. And some women might not need an accommodation at all. So they're short term, they're reasonable, they're low cost. And just looking at the number of Minnesota women, so if you look at women of childbearing age, there are approximately 99,000 Minnesota women who work for an employer with 15 or fewer employees. And we just want to make sure that they also have the right to a reasonable accommodation.
Representative Berg.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate the support for this language. I'm in agreement that this just makes sense for our workers, and I'm really pleased to hear that the agency supports this. Thank you.
Chair Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Senator Housley's question, it sounds like the answer from the department was no, they did not contact or work with anybody from industry to understand their concerns. They relied on Senator Coleman, and yet they prefer the House language without exercising that role of and that the commissioner likes to talk about. Just a couple of quick questions. Representative Hamilton asked about enforcement costs, and I just kind of ran through the bill. We have about $3.2 million to the department for safe and sick time, over a million for paid family medical leave, another 1.8 million for OSHA increased enforcement. So if I understand, Commissioner, you're asking for just over $6 million in additional enforcement efforts. And it looked like we gave about, both sides gave about 200,000 additional in wage theft. And certainly as the author of the Senate author of the wage theft bill, I'm interested in making sure that we keep those protections strong. Was there additional enforcement on wage theft that I missed in the spreadsheet?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I don't believe so.
Chair Pratt.
Thank you. And I do have one other quick question here. A second. I remember. It was Commissioner, both the House and the Senate carried forward some provisions for your IT modernization, yet the House cut it, and I'm looking for that appropriation or for that cut here. They reduced you by almost $850 million for the biennium. Can you talk about that cut to your IT modernization and what impact that will have?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, absolutely. Maybe it would be helpful if I give you just a 1 minute background on that. At the time where we thought the state was going to have a significant budget deficit, and state agencies were directed to prepare for 5% and 10% cuts in the general funding. We did an analysis, and because the Department of Labor and Industry have only one program that receive general fund, and that's the Labor Standards Program, anytime there is a required cut to general fund activities, it hits that unit extremely hard. And because it is still a fairly lean unit, we simply had no other choice in terms of identifying how or where such a cut would be made. We looked at the actual funding and where that funding was distributed to, and recognizing that we had $848,000 left in the appropriation for the IT, our choice was simple, either simple yet complex. Either we cut the technology fund or we would immediately have to go into laying off staff. Because of a number of different factors, COVID being one of those, we were still in the process of fully staffing up based on the wage theft appropriation. We had two choices, cut the IT or be prepared to lay off employees. We chose to identify the IT budget as the area that we would take the resources from if it became necessary. When the budget forecast improved, and we realized that the state would not be operating at a significant deficit, we reached out and asked the governor to reconsider the cut that we had identified. Again, the 480, 448 $1,000. And so at this time, we're simply asking that the resources that we had identified as a potential cut, that this body would instead not cut those funds and make those resources available to the agency to continue its important work. As I noted in my testimony, several of the systems that the $448,000 was intended to address began to lose vendor support in January of this year. And so we have to have resources to transform that work. Otherwise, it creates security concerns, instability concerns, and therefore we would appreciate if the conference committee adopts the Senate version of this request.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Chair Pratt.
No other questions.
Mr. Chair, you're on mute. Mr. Chair, you're muted.
Yep, I forgot again, twice today. I've got two more on the list. I just want to check with Chair Noor. You took your hand down, but did you have a question? And then Representative Hamilton will be right after.
Please go to Lead Hamilton.
Lead Hamilton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have one question, then I'll have a follow-up comment. Commissioner Robertson, I'm new to this committee, so forgive me if I have a naive question here, but any fines that are levied against businesses, so I had an earlier question on enforcement, but any fines that the department levies against businesses, are those fines collected? Are they, do they come back to the department or do they go into the general fund?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. Fines that are levied, some of that money does come back to the agency, and that money is deposited into the assigned risk safety account. And those penalties are then used to support the consultation efforts of the agency. So when you think of the OSHA penalty, the money does come back to the agency, but that money is set aside. It does not support the units where the fines were initiated. It instead supports the agency commitment to work with employers. Specifically, some of those resources then support the OSHA consultation program, which is the voluntary arm of Minnesota OSHA that works directly with employers to provide safety and health expertise, particularly for small businesses that cannot afford a safety expert. So those penalties on one hand go right back into supporting Minnesota businesses. The services that are provided by OSHA consultation that are funded from that, all of those services are free to employers. And in addition, we also make some of those resources available to employers for safety grants. So all of those penalty dollars go into that fund, and then they come out on the other end in a more supportive, it's there to provide assistance, it's there to provide a match and safety grant, it's there to allow employers to utilize the safety expertise without the fear of compliance.
Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner. And Commissioner, like I said, I'm new to this committee. However, I used to chair the Agriculture Committee, and I've also served on the Environment Committee and others. And one of my concerns with the monies that are the penalties collected coming back to the agency, I can just give one example on why I have concerns around that. With the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, originally the dollars collected, levied fines specifically to the ethanol industry, they would go into the general fund and they would collect around $70,000 to $90,000 a year. After the law was changed to where they could keep all the fines, they jumped from that roughly $90,000 a year up to over $3 million. And so that's something that I continue to be very concerned about. And I'm always going to be raising those questions to all the departments on how those fines are used once they're allocated towards a business. It's just an experience that I've had in the past and a concern that I have moving forward. So thank you so much for answering my question.
Thank you, Lead Hamilton. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just wanted to thank the commissioner for the presentation on DLI and some of the conversation about the cut on the IT. I know that is one piece of the pie. While we are actually increasing the operating cost, I understand the Senate is also cutting some of that. But I just wanted to follow up on the apprenticeship program. There's a program that is going to be ending from the federal grant, and we do have increase of expenditure on that. I just wanted to know, is that coming from the general fund, and why do we need to do continuous funding for that program? Commissioner.
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Noor, the request for the operating increase for apprenticeship would not come from the general fund. It would come from the Workforce Development Fund. Registered apprenticeship is the premier workforce development model program here at Labor and Industry, and it could be inferred that it is the premier workforce development tool, not just at Labor and Industry. And therefore, recognizing that registered apprenticeship has the ability to move individuals from poverty to solidly in the middle class by training and educating and providing individuals with the on-the-job training that's needed in order for them to master any particular craft. This powerful earn-as-you-learn model combines the structure of on-the-job training and related technical and safety instructions that results in a nationally recognized credential. We often refer to apprenticeship as the other four-year degree that you are able to obtain without the super high costs. And so the specific funding that we are looking at, we get to today because we were successful in receiving a federal grant. And with that grant, we were able to hire an additional field rep whose priority was to provide outreach and education and to work with employers and joint apprenticeship committees to help them expand their reach, specifically to communities of color, to women, and to our indigenous population. We believe that the efforts of the apprenticeship unit to help employers grow and understand how do you get to that particular group. We think it's valuable, and we think that it is quite worthy of continued support. We have received feedback from our stakeholders, the Joint Apprenticeship Committees in particular, who lack the internal resources, and maybe because they just don't have the breadth or the reach of the state in order to really share that message. We think registered apprenticeship is a great program, not just good, but great. We see the benefits of it. It is one of the few programs that with almost 100% certainty would allow an individual to earn a family-sustaining wage, not just when they complete the program, but really well into the program, they are meeting that strategic goal of being able to earn a reasonable wage that would support a family. And for those reasons, we think that it's critically important, and we would like to see this position continue here at Labor and Industry. It provides that value. It gives those employers the opportunity for that direct engagement with our staff to say, how do we get more people into registered apprenticeship?
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Commissioner Robertson. This is an important conversation to have in terms of providing individuals family-sustaining wage, and apprenticeship is quite frankly an important component of this. So thank you so much for the work that the department does. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a couple of questions for the commissioner for presentation, but first off, before I answer this one, I'll let you know that Commissioner Robertson and I have a past history with the MnSTAR program at the company I retired from. So this my next question relates to OSHA inspections. So we've had quite an involvement over the years on this kind of thing, and we didn't even realize it till just recently on this. But anyway. Commissioner, Minnesota OSHA, how does Minnesota OSHA enforcement compare to other state plans of similar size and maybe similar industrial footprint?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. How does Minnesota compare? Well, if you talk to our national partners, Minnesota OSHA is considered a premier program. A model program for many reasons. We have been a national leader in terms of adopting some standards here at starting in Minnesota and other state plan states and even the federal OSHA program modeling some of their standards after Minnesota OSHA. So on one hand, we enjoy an excellent reputation. On the other hand, because of course I have two, we see that Minnesota OSHA continues to lose ground. Minnesota has about 1.5 million people, and at this time we only have 43 OSHA inspectors. When we look around at other similar, close, comparable states in terms of population, we start to see some deviation. Oregon has 4.2 million people, and they have 85 OSHA inspectors. Almost 1 million citizens less, and yet they have almost double, one inspector shy of doubling their inspector ranks. Kentucky has 4.5 million people. Again, at least 1 million less than Minnesota. And they have the same complement as Minnesota OSHA, 43 inspectors. Indiana has more citizens, yet they have 70 inspectors. And so when we look at other state plan states, we simply see that we are continuing to lose ground. This past pandemic put an enormous, it just put OSHA really at the front and center. And we saw where the minimum staffing that we have at this time can be exhausted and cannot meet the needs of both employees and employers. And so I think comparatively, we can't live on reputation alone. We're losing ground. And if we do not close this gap, one, we're going to exhaust the existing staff. And then two, we would be failing the citizens, both employers and employees in the state of Minnesota, if we cannot meet our statutory obligation to inspect promptly with complaints, fatalities, or imminent danger. We also provide a great deal of assistance to employers. Because the funding has stayed flat for such a long time, as I indicated, the overall staffing of the unit has declined substantially from 75 FTEs in 2012 down to 62 FTEs in 2020, with 43 of those FTEs dedicated to the inspection class.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. And then my final question is, we have a section of construction codes, and the Department of Labor and Industry objected to the frost footing question in the Fargo-Moorhead area. My question that is, when has the agency contacted your counterparts in North Dakota to talk about what issues they may have or not have with these proposed changes and that you're objecting to, when the soil types and everything are so much similar on both sides of the river?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your question. And I certainly respect the author's request for the change. However, we feel strongly that significant changes to the construction code across Minnesota really should, if we don't begin at the Construction Code Advisory Council, it certainly should get to the Construction Code Advisory Council, so that the team of experts that look at the code in its totality have an opportunity to weigh in on different suggestions. We believe that the Construction Code Advisory Council is in the best.
Yeah, you muted yourself, Commissioner.
Okay, thanks. Resting on my space bar. Sorry about that. We simply believe that the Construction Code Advisory Council is the best space to properly evaluate significant changes to the code. When this issue came to our attention in working with the Construction Code and Licensing Division staff, we started to think about how do we adequately explore this request for change. And so the Construction Code Advisory Council at this time is considering developing a technical advisory group to study this frost level requirement.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other member questions for Senator Eakin?
Thank you, Chair Eklund, and thank you for raising the issue and that question. And thank you, Commissioner Robertson, for being here today. And I understand your desire and concern that this issue be thoroughly vetted. I do think, that one of the concerns that I have is the fact that it has just gone through the advisory council has already gone through that process, and it's a 6-year cycle. They've updated the codes based on this last cycle, so it wouldn't be for another 6 years before there would be an opportunity for any change. That's a long time, and so I would hope that that we could do things more quickly. And the fact is that, as Chair Eklund had said, there is a lot of information from North Dakota about frost footings being at the 54 inches instead of the 60 inches. They've been doing it for decades now. So I think that it would be good for the department to consult with North Dakota, see if they've had any issues on the Fargo side of the river with the homes they've been building at the 54-inch level for frost footings, because I think that we already have a trove of information to base our decision on here as we move forward. So I guess I'd just be, requesting that that there be a connection and consultation with folks on the North Dakota side and see if we can learn something from them about their experiences. But thank you again, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, we do have the Executive Director of the Construction Code and Licensing Division with us today. I'd like to invite him if he can provide any additional enlightenment around this subject. Scott McKellen.
Mr. McKellen.
Yes, good morning, Chair Eklund and Conference Committee members. My name is Scott McKellen. I am the Director of Construction Codes and Licensing. And Senator Eakin and committee members, I can say that we have, in fact, reached out to North Dakota regulators and home builders while this bill was being debated in the Senate and the House, and found a number of interesting anecdotes about perspectives from North Dakota, which are all interesting, that range from, even though our code says 54 inches, most people build to 60 inches. Again, that's anecdote from the Fargo Building Department. And yet home builders say that that's not necessarily true. So fast forwarding to what Commissioner Robertson said about the Construction Code Advisory Council. In fact, we do have a meeting scheduled for May 28th, and I have personally heard from North Dakota Home Builders Association, and we've invited one of their builders to attend the meeting, make a presentation, and even sit on a technical advisory group with a home builder from Minnesota, as well as our staff structural engineer, to do a brief review over the course of the coming probably several months to study the issue to see if it warrants a change in the Moorhead area. And as the commissioner mentioned earlier, if a change is warranted in that area, we would believe that adjoining areas should also be able to benefit from that same change in frost depth. So we have committed to exploring that issue, and an initial meeting has been set for May 28th.
Senator Eakin.
Well, thank you, Mr. McCollum. I really appreciate you reaching out to the North Dakota side. From what I've heard from home builders on the North Dakota side, they have been building to the 54-inch level levels there as well. So we do have homes at that 54-inch level that have been standing for many years now. I think there's plenty of information there to ascertain as to whether the 54-inch level should be sufficient here. But I appreciate the information. I appreciate you reaching out. So thank you.
Any other member questions for Commissioner Robertson or staff? I don't see any right now. Commissioner Robertson, thank you so much for presenting, and we appreciate your input on the various provisions in the bill, and we'll keep moving forward.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Thank you for having me today and giving me the opportunity to share the agency's position.
Mr. Conference Committee members, I've got one question before I turn the chair back over to Chair Noor, and it's for Deputy Commissioner Stockstead of the Bureau of Mediation Services. And Mr. Stockstead, Commissioner Stockstead, could you give us a brief rundown of how long the PIRB board has been in play and enacted into law, and your take on the funding portion of it in the House bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Eklund, the PIRB board has actually been in statute since 2014. It became operational this past July 1st, and they started accepting unfair labor practice complaints or filings on that day, but there's a six-month look back. So any unfair labor practice from January 1st of this year, or excuse me, from January 1st of last year through July could also have been filed. There has been 16 filings to date, and the first hearing is coming up, I think, on this Friday, actually.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any member questions for Deputy Commissioner Stockstead from Bureau of Mediation Services? Thank you, members. Thank you, Commissioner Stockstead, for sitting in. I will turn the next portion back over to Chair Noor, because I see Commissioner Grove is with us. Chair Noor.
Thank you so much, Chair Eklund, and members, for the questions and digging deep into the conversation about the DLI. With that, I just wanted to welcome Commissioner Grove. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Hello, everybody. I'm Steve Groh, the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And thanks for having me here today. It's so good to see my favorite legislators from both bodies, both parties, all in one room. Feels like kind of a reunion. This is the best part of the session where we get to make things happen. So thanks for having me. We're thrilled to be here. I also just want to say, having obviously worked with both committees throughout this session, know how hard both the Senate and the House have worked to put these packages into play. They are complex. They are deep. It's a challenging endeavor to work across so many stakeholders and issues to put together budgets. And we're just really grateful for all the hard work and eager to come to a conclusion that is best for Minnesota businesses and Minnesota workers. As you know, the governor's budget and his focus on DEED has really been focused on COVID-19 recovery, in particular, immediate rescue assistance to those most affected by the challenges of the last year, a very specific focus on small businesses and startups. That's where the need is greatest. That's where all the job growth that we need so much is going to come from. And then to strengthen our workforce is another major component of the governor's thesis for this budget. And we know we need to really play to our advantage of having a great talent ecosystem in our state and strengthen that workforce to help our businesses and our communities thrive. So the effects of this pandemic have been very uneven, as we've talked about in both committees throughout this session. They've hit workers of color and low-wage workers hardest, and they've hit small businesses hardest. So we really kind of started there as a first principle in our discussions with all of you, and know that will be a big component of the final conversations that come in these remaining days of the session. So I want to offer a couple of thoughts on the provisions in both bills and some things that we like and things that we're concerned about, and share some thoughts on where we go from here. I think maybe the first issue to tackle, and it's really one that's been on the top of every one of your constituents' minds and all of our minds throughout this year, has been unemployment insurance. It is extraordinary to think what this program has had to do over the past year to help Minnesotans stay afloat throughout one of the most challenging periods in our state's history. We've paid out billions of dollars in unemployment insurance, made all kinds of changes to the program to ensure that it works. And throughout that process, I think everyone has seen kind of what works and what doesn't in the system. And I think, you know, both the House and the Senate have proposed some really thoughtful changes to the unemployment insurance program that we're really eager to discuss. The governor's proposed changes that include removing the provision of UI law that makes secondary students ineligible for unemployment. This is a totally outdated law that prevents high school students from accessing those benefits, even though their employers pay in taxes on their wages to the system. So it's a really unfair and sort of bizarre statute in Minnesota state law that I think both bodies want to change. The Senate wants to wait until the TUST fund is at a positive balance of $750 million, however, to make that change, which does concern us. You know, we would like to stay away from tying the extension of these benefits to secondary students until some certain point in the future. We would say that, you know, the federal government is covering them through September, but at that point, these benefits could kick in. We just don't know how long it's going to take to pay back the UI Trust Fund. It is not a certain time in the future. It could be years. We will see. That's a whole other discussion. But in the meantime, the benefits to the kids who would get this money, who would deserve it in the same way that any of their work in our ecosystem and in our economy would, are extraordinary. This is money that young students are using to support their families. They're using it to put food on the table for their families. And it's just a basic issue of fairness. And I think just to put it into perspective, you know, adding young people in particular to our unemployment insurance system would add an amount of debt, we think, between $20 to $30 million a year, roughly. That's 0.01% of our current trust fund debt. So it's just an infinitesimal marginal effect on our trust fund. So to hold that back until the trust fund builds up just seems like maybe philosophically I can kind of understand it, but practically really makes no difference. And when we talk to business leaders and we talk to the chamber and others, this is just not a major concern of theirs. So we would encourage timing this to the end of the federal benefits rather than a trust fund positive balance. And I think just lastly, on unemployment insurance, there are some provisions in both bills that look at retroactive changes to the program. Those are extremely difficult to administer and in some cases impossible to administer. So we would really encourage this body to not enact any retroactive changes to the program. Our program is under extraordinary strain to pay out money every week to your constituents. We want to make sure we can continue to deliver on that promise rather than having to navigate complex retroactive changes to our policy. So that's unemployment insurance, and it'll be a great discussion in this committee and beyond, and we're looking forward to that. Another area that we're eager to engage with you all on is our Workforce Development Fund. And this is an extraordinary thing about Minnesota. We're the only state in the country that has this fund. It is, of course, built up by a payroll tax that comes in from employers across Minnesota. And it's become one of the true differentiations of our state and our ability to build a great workforce. That money comes into deed. We manage it through a public board and ensure that people get the kind of training they need to get back into the economy. But the fund, which was created in the 80s, really has not been modernized in the last 30 or 40 years. So it is an outdated structure for how it operates. When we sat here in this committee 2 years ago, there was a lot of discussions about how to better use that fund. And it always kind of went down to the lowest common denominator, which is if we can't change the structure, let's just make this a fund where we do direct appropriations to certain organizations we know are doing good work. We think we can do a lot better than that. And we've talked to Republicans, Democrats, nonprofit leaders, business leaders. We've undertaken really a journey since the last session to reimagine how this fund could be more efficient, more fair, more rooted in equity, more rooted in the common and modern challenges our economy faces, and to really center our grant making on performance. What are we doing to get the most value out of every dollar that we get from the business community to build up a workforce that can then help those businesses grow and help workers find great jobs? So we've been through a lengthy process to engage stakeholders from across our economy on this. We believe we have a really thoughtful and fair an equitable reform package in play. The House has supported that. The Senate bill does not make any of these changes. We would really encourage this body to consider those changes. We think that they could make a big difference by making the fund more fair, more transparent, holding us indeed accountable, frankly, for how we make those decisions and get money out the door, and ensure that we're helping those who need it most. Notably, this is no additional cost to employers. We're not suggesting an increase in taxes or more money that will go into this. It's just a modern, common sense set of reforms we think will be helpful, and we're just very eager to work on that with all of you. So I'd also just like to add that, you know, these reforms, because the fund at its current level operates in a way that is structurally pretty inefficient, we've been able to find a way that we can get thousands of more of your constituents workforce development help and continue to serve every single dislocated worker who needs those benefits when they're laid off. And that's important. We don't want to leave anybody behind, and we don't think that we will with these reforms. And so we encourage you to consider them. You know, I think with unemployment insurance and the Workforce Development Fund both being policy issues for which a general fund target isn't necessary to navigate the way forward, I would just share with both committee chairs here that the department stands ready and willing whenever you are to begin discussions on both of those, because we think they're big and important ones for us to get right for Minnesota. Another area that we are very bullish on, that the entire state is very bullish on, is a program called Launch Minnesota. This is an extremely successful program that legislators from both sides of the aisle and both bodies created along with DEED last session, which really helps to galvanize our early stage startup ecosystem and provide grants to early stage founders, give education grants to organizations to help would-be founders figure out how to start a company. This is really important because while Minnesota has a lot of innovative companies, we rank near the back of the pack nationally in terms of the number of new entrepreneurs every year. We're 47th out of 50, according to the Kauffman Foundation on that front. So especially at a time of recession and a time of renewal, which we're in right now, encouraging as many Minnesotans to start new things, new businesses that will frankly become the next Fortune 500s in our state, is just an essential part of any economic recovery. The program isn't huge. It's about $5 million. Again, it's in the House bill. It is not in the Senate bill. It's going to be even more important on our recovery than it has been the past few years. It has a host of advocates, as I'm sure many of you have noticed from your inboxes and phone lines, from across the state, particularly greater Minnesota, where we believe it should be as easy to start a company as it is here in the metro. So we think it's an important program. I will say, you know, when we launched it, we envisioned that, like some programs, we might start it in state government and eventually spin it out, right? Like get it going in state government and then spin it out to an outside organization. Of course, we would never advocate for not spending the grant dollars there, because that's a great role that state government can play. But spinning it out could help us work with the private sector more. So the original legislation did ask us to consider that approach, which we did. Careful consideration with our private sector advisory board revealed the unanimous conclusion that it was not ready to do that at this time. We took a careful look at it. There just isn't an organization right now who's in a place to take on those responsibilities. And the pandemic just makes that a more challenging thing. So we should still look at it, but the overwhelming feedback that we've got is that we can play a uniquely neutral role and a sort of honest broker role in convening a state ecosystem here. So we are bullish on Launch Minnesota, and we'd love to engage all of you on making that program continue. There's a lot in to discuss around how we help small businesses, I think, in this committee. And I want to talk, you know, just beyond startups and tech companies, we want to look at the small businesses across the state that we can help. And times of recession are when they grow even more. But in fact, it's much more challenging to start a small business if you're a person of color, if you're a woman, if you're a veteran, and sometimes if you're in greater Minnesota as well. And so the governor included about $6 million over the biennium in his budget for entrepreneur support. This is, you know, nonprofit lenders leveraging other capital sources, incubators that can serve early stage small businesses. There's versions of this in the House bill and the governor's bill too. We would really encourage this body to think very specifically about how small businesses can get the help that they need through these support organizations that are quite unique to Minnesota, but again, are one of the secret sauces to why we have such a great and flourishing small business ecosystem. So that's an area that we would encourage this body to think about at length. You know, I think another area that we know has shifted so much in the past 10 years, but even more so in the past year, is the influence of automation on our economy. You're all seeing this every day in your districts with the businesses, especially manufacturers, who are finding new ways to get things done with machines that are, by adopting automation, finding a way to up-level the skills of those who use those machines. So it's really a growth opportunity for the careers of folks in these industries. The particular area where this is challenging is for some of our smaller manufacturers. So the 100 or less manufacturers where, you know, automating comes with a cost in terms of training the worker that you have, making that transition, and ultimately could be used to create more jobs. And so we've been piloting a program where we use grants to help manufacturers automate certain processes, as long as that automation doesn't end up in the loss of a single job, because that's important. We want to grow jobs, not replace them. And that they can use that training to help their workers advance career skills. So we have about $500,000 in the budget here. The House does too for that kind of training. It's really critical to put our economy on the leading edge. And it's a unique program that the pilot has shown to be really successful. And we encourage this body to consider. There are some policies in the Senate's omnibus bill related to the governor's authority to navigate safe business operations during COVID-19. Not surprisingly, we are against these policies. They would limit the governor's powers in a public health emergency to protect the public. As we've all seen, this past year has been an extraordinary test of our state's ability to keep Minnesotans safe and to balance public health and economic activity at the same time, while really focusing on the well-being of Minnesotans is our central goal. And as we come into these, what we hope are the final stages of the pandemic, we want to continue to do what we've done all along, which is to seek collaboration with the legislature, not only on what we should do, but how to provide financial and regulatory relief. And I've had the pleasure of working with Senators Pratt, Representative Knorr, and so many others on several versions of those packages that have helped. And I would just say that, you know, to recklessly remove the governor's ability to take care of extraordinarily critical pandemic response issues without any of those safeguards would be a bad decision at this point in the pandemic. And so we caution the committee against including those provisions in your final bill. There's also a provision in the Senate's omnibus bill that would cut DEED's administrative funding for various programs down to 2%. And, you know, look, as someone who comes from business, I totally understand and appreciate the desire to make organizations run more efficiently. In fact, that's been a major focus of mine since coming on board as your DEED commissioner. We have really clean house and a whole host of processes and countless rules that slow down operations. We're getting grants out the door now 3 months faster, 6 months faster than they have in the past. This is a major priority of ours. But I think it's important to separate running efficient programs from running quality programs. And if you decrease our admin, it hurts our ability to serve your constituents more effectively. Never before have we had our workforce tested within state government so much to help your constituents get what they need, whether that's through unemployment insurance, through business assistance programs, through small business supports. We are working 24/7, literally, on these issues. And cutting our admin now is just the wrong time to consider such a measure. It also, by the way, would inhibit our ability to do the kind of oversight of taxpayer dollars that are so necessary to running an effective operation. So we strongly oppose this provision, of course. We just don't think it makes sense right now. And DEED doesn't have some sort of special operating budget allocation that we can pull from. Admin is really how we run the agency. So it's a critical component of how we can make sure your constituents are getting what they need. There are a couple other provisions in the bill I wanted to mention. One of them is how we address an issue related to a grant program that we ran late last year that excluded some applicants to the grant program based on their NAICS codes. This is a code that you code your business in as you register with the state. Some people had registered themselves in an incorrect category years ago, and then when they applied for funding for these grants, were ineligible because they weren't one of the designated business categories. You've heard about this from several of your constituents. I've met personally with many of you and with many of your businesses to discuss this. And we've looked at, is there any way to solve this for those who kind of hadn't coded themselves correctly? And we believe at the end of the day, unfortunately, that it's nearly impossible to administer such a change and that it would lack any compelling safeguards at all. So while I'm totally sympathetic to that concern, I think the better way to tackle that more broadly is just to focus on another round of business supports and making sure that we construct those in a way in which the letter of the legislation does not use just NAICS codes as the way that we usher folks in. So I think it's a noble effort to try to fix that. I just think that we've dug into that so deeply and spent so much time on it. I don't think there's a way forward to fix it in the way that it's been proposed. You know, I think more broadly on COVID-19 assistance, we would agree with both the Senate and the House that we are not out of the woods yet and that assistance directly to businesses who've been affected is really important. We have a $50 million program in our budget to help businesses get the kind of money they need. The House has something similar. The Senate has a small business loan guarantee program. You know, I think we got to come to a conclusion on this. It's going to take some hard work together to figure out the right angle. I think generally what we're hearing is that businesses want grants, not loans. And the loan guarantee program, as it is currently constructed, we have some concerns that it's solving the right problem and that it will actually get more capital out. We did run a similar program last session, and it took almost a year to get just $7.5 million of the $10 million allocated out the door for that program. But we appreciate the creativity, and there's got to be a way to construct a program here that gets grants, if possible, maybe loans in some cases, out to businesses who wouldn't otherwise get a loan. That's, I think, the problem we need to solve. It's not that people don't have access to bank dollars who usually would be able to walk into a bank. It's for those who wouldn't. So we're eager to discuss this. I think it's a fruitful area for collaboration and excited to discuss that with both bodies. And then a couple of final points because I'm eager to get to your questions. One is just on paid family medical leave, obviously in the House bill and not the Senate. This is something we think is so important. Investing in our workforce and in our Minnesotans' prosperity means not just helping train them, but helping them when life happens. And this pandemic has taught us that life happens in ways that we can never truly predict. In normal times, about 10% of Minnesotans take a family or medical leave in a given year. And about 25% of those are not including wage replacement. Some studies say that if you take 12 weeks off from your job on average as an adult, you lose almost $10,000. So this is real money that you probably need even more when a life event occurs rather than less. And we think that our program is a thoughtful one. It helps small businesses in particular who don't have the kind of scale to produce their own programs. And we think we can do it through a similar structure to the unemployment insurance system in a way that only costs about a cup of coffee per week. So we urge this body to consider that plan. And then I'd just say lastly on childcare, this is an issue I know you hear from your constituents about every single day. Lack of access to accessible, affordable, quality childcare is a crisis in Minnesota, full stop. It just is. And we know that's the case. We're grateful that both the Senate and the House have childcare proposals in their budgets. We have a proposal focused on an open and competitive grant program. The House and Senate have similar proposals. The Senate proposal involves getting the MIFs involved, which I think is a thoughtful direction too. So we need to work this out, but we've got to think big about childcare. I know other committees are doing the same. This is a workforce issue, and particularly in greater Minnesota, because that's where the childcare access is really dropping off and where the most attention is really needed. So we applaud both bodies for considering childcare and are eager to figure out our way forward there. So lots more to discuss. Again, thank you for having me, eager to discuss all these issues ahead. We think that this is a really historic opportunity as a conference committee here to put a bold vision forward for how we're gonna rescue this economy from the challenge of the last year, rebuild in the right way, given the challenges that we face, and really strengthen our workforce. There are states who come out of recessions like this better than others, and nothing's inevitable that Minnesota will be one of those. We need to make sure we do the right things to get us there. So, Mr. Chair, thanks for the time, and I'll stand for your questions.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Indeed, we do have a bold proposal before us from the House, and we'll look through and where we agree with the Senate. I just wanted to ask if members have any questions for the Commissioner. Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, you and I had talked way back in January. And back then, and ever since then, and we've been talking about safely reopening businesses, retool, retrain employees, and get them back to work. And, Representative Baker had a clear plan outlining way back then on how to get these businesses safely reopened. And Commissioner, I think that it's long past overdue to fully open up these businesses. And as you know, I represent a district that borders Iowa. And even during the times of the pandemic, the closure of these businesses, people from the district that I serve were still going out to eat. They're still going out for a cocktail. They're still getting married. They were just doing it in Iowa. And so all that revenue was going down there. And I had businesses calling me daily, and I'm not kidding about that, saying, look, we need help. And if we being the government, are going to close businesses down for the greater good, then government and greater good should pay these businesses to be closed. And when I brought that up to you, it was said back to me that we do not have enough resources as a state to fully pay these businesses to make them whole. We have individuals like Representative Baker, Poston, Frankie. They were sharing on the House floor that the hardships that they're experiencing personally, one, for being closed, and now that they're starting to reopen, that they cannot hire people to fill the positions that they have open because of the unemployment benefits. And Representative Frankie shared that he's been trying to hire a cook since last year. Representative Poston said on the House floor, if you have anybody that is unemployed in your district, send them to the district that he oversees or that he represents, because they have jobs for them now. And so my question, referring back to a report that your department released on the 27th of April, the title of that was Job Vacancies Are Up 14%. And so my first question is, why are we as a department and others that are looking to expand unemployment benefits when the businesses that we have operating today cannot even hire people to fill those positions? That'll be my first question.
Commissioner Grove.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, the concerns you raise are valid. There's no question. And I think particularly for districts that border states with different policies, this has been more of a challenging pandemic. I think, you know, when you look at the holistic approach Minnesota has taken compared to our border states, I, for one, as just a citizen, am glad I live here. The numbers of deaths, hospitalizations, COVID cases, so much higher in all of our bordering states. But those things are challenging to get right for every governor and every state, and different states have taken different approaches. You know, I want to make sure that we're characterized previous conversations correctly. Any conversation on business assistance that you had with me, I'm certain, did not result in me simply saying, we don't have the money, let's give up. I don't know if there's been any department or any commissioner who's fought harder for money for businesses than the one you're looking at right now. And that's because every single day I talk to small businesses across Minnesota who are struggling, just like you do. And it's been a difficult year. You know, it may be the mathematical truth that it is impossible to pay every business across this country the exact amount of money for which they lost during this pandemic. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't find every single way that we can. And this bill that the House puts forward and that we put forward does just that. On the question of loosening restrictions, I think we've all seen as we looked at the numbers, which I'm sure you do every day, as do I, we just went through what looked like a third surge of the virus. We are now coming down from the peak of that. As you've heard the governor say on a couple of occasions this week, we are in active discussions about what that means for an exit strategy for restrictions. We considered Representative Baker and many others in the legislature key allies and confidants and advisors on how to handle this situation. We are largely open as an economy right now, but save for very large events indoors and for some minor restrictions on indoor businesses that are smaller. They may seem minor, but they're important to the businesses who are there. And we know that, for example, social distancing at 6 feet itself makes it very difficult for a restaurant to get the kind of numbers they need to get the kind of profits that that they should enjoy. So I agree with you, and the governor would agree with you, that we want to be in a place as soon as possible to lift all restrictions. And that's a very active discussion that we're having right now with businesses, with workers, and with legislators as well. You know, on the issue of job vacancies, you're right. We are now at a place where we have as many job vacancies in our economy as we did Q4 of 2019, so about where we were before the pandemic. Difference is, of course, we're still in the middle of a pandemic and there's virus circulating and beyond. There is a fair argument to be made that one of the challenges that businesses face right now is the extra $300 that the federal government put into unemployment insurance. Again, that's a federal policy that added an additional $300 per week to workers. That's not a state policy, that's a federal policy. There are lots of good reasons that federal policy exists, and we hear anecdotal evidence from businesses today, as I know you do too and alluded to, that maybe that's keeping people on the sidelines of our economy. None of the proposals in our bill or the House's bill as it relates to unemployment insurance are about extending the amount of money that we put into benefits for people. They're simply about the basic human fairness issue that if you're a 16 or 17 year old and you are working the same amount of hours and same wages and same activities as any other Minnesotan, and your employer is paying taxes into the system, which currently exists, you should be eligible like everybody else. And like I said, the cost of that, by the way, this law that existed that made that the case that we face today, from 1939. It's about as anachronistic of a law as you can exist, and almost no other state in the nation has it. Adding that group of people to our unemployment insurance system from an eligibility perspective adds 0.01% at most to the trust fund debt that we have today. So it's just simply not the same issue. The issue of the top off, I get it. The issue of adding high school students as a basic fairness issue, or in the case of the House and Senate bill, looking at some changes for seniors, is just a very different issue. It's not the same issue at all. So I appreciate these points. They're important. We need to grapple with all of this. And I can just tell you that every single day, we as a department wake up in the morning and are calling people on unemployment insurance and pointing them towards jobs. We've called over 12,000 Minnesotans in the last month personally on the phone to point them to the good jobs that are available in our economy now. It's just what we're doing every single day. We've sent over 200,000 letters last week to those on unemployment insurance, directing them towards career opportunities that are there. It is the thing we kind of wake up and go to bed thinking about every day, because it's our job to help business find workers. And if we're not being proactive about that, then what are we doing? So it's a major issue. We'd love your help on it. And I'm glad you're raising these topics.
And Mr. Chairman.
Proceed, Lead Hamlet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, don't mischaracterize what I said. I didn't say that you said nothing could be done and that we should just throw in the towel and give up. What I said was there are not enough resources, meaning money, to make these businesses whole. And here we have the hospitality industry that are fighting for scraps, if you will. And what we're saying is we may have a loan for you. The businesses, the restaurant owners that are calling me, they're saying, look, what good is a loan going to do me when I can't afford the loans that I have? This is where we have to do everything we can to get these businesses open. That's the other thing that they're saying to me is, Rod, just let us reopen to the full extent. And with that said, when it comes to unemployment, I'm not talking. When I'm talking about Representative Poston, Baker, Frankie, and others are saying we can't hire anybody, they're not talking about that high school kid that needs the unemployment benefits. What they're talking about is individuals that are able-bodied adults that can be employed are simply not coming off unemployment to fill those positions. And so that's what we need to address. And again, I revert back to the article that was published about job vacancies are up. We need to make sure that we're working with these business owners. And when I say we, I'm talking about government, the departments, the governor, us on this committee need to be working with these businesses to make sure that our policies are lining up with them. If our businesses are screaming that we need employees, then why are we looking at extending unemployment benefits? We should be getting people off these benefits to fill these jobs that are vacant. And when we also have businesses that are screaming, and one owner that I have in the district that I brought this up multiple times, he's a farmer and he owns a bar and a restaurant. He is selling farm equipment so that he can pay his bills to keep his restaurant open, his bar restaurant open. I said, it's a little counterproductive with spring right around the corner. He says, Hamilton, what am I supposed to do? We have a complete disconnect between government and the policies that we are making and these businesses that are fighting simply to survive. And, you know, Commissioner, this is why I bring this up every single time. We need to make sure that the policies that we're pushing forward are supporting these businesses. And this is another disconnect that I'm going to say. We agree that employees are absolutely essential to help these businesses. Businesses cannot survive with employees. Where I believe the disconnect is not everybody agrees that businesses are absolutely essential for employees. It's both that we have to make sure that we are accommodating, and to add additional burden on businesses that are already struggling, how are they going to weather the storm? You know, and so again, we need to be reaching out to these businesses to make sure we fully understand what they're going through and what they need as we progress. And that's where I think the disconnect is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Lead Hamilton. I think I wanted to follow up a little bit. I think you talked about the support that is needed for the hospitality industry. I can assure you, I think a conversation with the commissioner and some of the staff in regards to the support. One of the initiatives that we're putting here is to provide that technical assistance for the federal grant program, which is the restaurant revitalization program, which is coming up soon, and also to look into Save Our Stages, which is another federal program, and also the state small business credit initiative. Those are great programs that we can really help assist the business that are struggling. I know we cannot make anybody whole because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We did not choose the virus. It came to us. We're living with it. We're adjusting to it. And I think we are actually seeing the light at the end of the tunnel as we see many people getting vaccinated and getting back to normalcy. In fact, I go around in my district and outside to see how some of the businesses are functioning, some of the struggles that we know, particularly for the women. I think we can talk more about those issues in the coming up days, but I wanted to let other members to ask questions if they have. Commissioner, I don't know if you wanted to follow up.
No, I think that's well said, Representative. I mean, Representative Hamilton, I hear the passion in your voice, and I understand it. This is a challenging time. There's just no question about it. And I guess I just want to assure you that as your Commissioner of Deed, the challenges you've outlined are the challenges that we are tackling every day. I don't know that there's the disconnect there that you maybe think that there is. We understand the challenges of businesses. I spend hours a week on roundtables and out in districts and talking to them, and I get the challenges that businesses face, and I don't think that the solution to our current economic woe is to just focus on entitlement programs. These budget packages are broad, and they include a wide variety of things. And I agree with you that grants, not loans, are probably where we need to focus. I don't have any businesses banging down our door for a loan right now, to your point. So I think, you know, that kind of thinking is smart. It's that feedback that's needed, and I just appreciate your advocacy and passion for business. I share it.
Chair Pratt.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Hamilton's comments, as well as, you know, maybe clarify a little bit of the Senate position. Yes, we do create a guaranteed loan program with a deferred payment out for 12 months, specifically, Representative Hamilton, for the issues that you raised. Being shut down so long has really hurt the cash flow of many of our small businesses. Grants have kind of a limited amount that you can give and still be really effective and meaningful. And what the loan program has done is allow us to take $100 million, pay for the first years of interest payments, put some technical assistance, and create $250 million in lendable assets. To the chair's position on, you know, we didn't ask for the virus that came to us. That's true. But, you know, we had conversations with the commissioner dating back to over a year ago, around the governor's approach. I appreciate his meeting with many of the businesses in Prior Lake, talking about what we called at the time a safe shopping zone, which would have allowed our small boutiques and our restaurants to open up. It took us 6 weeks to get that implemented. So while I agree we didn't ask for the virus, I think in some cases we have not taken as balanced of approaches as I would have advocated for in our response. But it's not just about a loan program either. It's about, and I've had conversations with both Chair Knorr and Commissioner Grove about utilizing some of the $2 billion that the state's going to be getting to create a grant program so that we have both a grant program which gives immediate relief to businesses, but then long-term loan programs that might help with reconstruction, with capital improvements that a grant program just can't cover. So it's not an either-or. From our position, it's an and. We just don't have the federal funding in this bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yep, go ahead, Commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Senator Pratt, thank you for that. And there's a pathway forward here for sure, right? You know, loans, grants, we're going to have to figure this out. I think our hope would be that we just try to solve the biggest challenges that we know that exist in the market. And if we can find a way to make a loan guarantee program solve those challenges, let's do it. Like, let's collaborate and find a way to make that happen. I think what we've heard from talking to bankers, from talking to lenders and others, is that the biggest challenge is actually those who could never walk into a bank and get a loan in the first place. And so how do we get some of those loan dollars out to organizations who can take on a bit more risk with applicants in ways that banks aren't allowed to do based on the regulations that exist today? I think having some conversations in that direction could help us. But I think there are going to be some creative solutions here. And I think you're probably right that loans and grants are going to have to play a role in that. So we may disagree on some of the actions of the last year. There's no question there. But the big the big issue for this committee is how we go forward. How do we build a package, a bill, a use of funds that really focuses on the future of our economy and how we rebuild it? And the sun shines a little bit brighter every day that relates to COVID. We are coming close to a new chapter in this. And I think if we can feel that optimism in our sails a bit as we have these discussions, it'll help us.
Chair Pratt.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just look at a comparable state like Wisconsin, who's been, I think, taken more of a balanced approach, has had more engagement with the legislature and has 321 fewer deaths than our state. I think there's room for us to accelerate the recovery and look forward to working with you, the commissioner, and the rest of the conference committee to move that forward.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. And I hear you. And I think the question about loans versus grants and all those things, you mentioned the federal program. As far as I'm aware of the loan guarantee, we can really substitute that with the state small business credit initiative, which is federally funded, not with the $2 billion that we're getting. This is a separate fund, and including the restaurant revitalization program. How do we get that information to the hospitality industry? How do we get that information to allow the businesses to recover in a good way? I think it's really critical that we have a way to extend ourselves and to be able to begin with the program we have in our bill, which is up to 100,000 for small businesses, you know, especially small businesses. We know that the K-shaped recovery didn't support the small business industry that we know. All large corporations took advantage of that, and they're doing very well. We're more worried about the small businesses, the small mom and pop shops that need this assistance, that we can really help them succeed. I think their success is our success, and that their success is also the success of the workers. We need to look into that whole totality, and I agree with you. We need to have more thorough conversation on this going forward. With that, I just also wanted to have some other questions with the commissioner, if no other members got any question. Commissioner Grove, appreciate that you know, the work that we did with the Workforce Development Fund realignment. If you look at the hearings that we have had, we've listened to many organizations, some of them who came with really innovative ways of doing business, including some who came to us and told us about pay for performance, some new ways that they can really help to jumpstart the economy in terms of helping workers. More than $60 million request came before us. In fact, our goal is to safeguard this money, not for business development, but for more for workforce development. Indeed, it follows the intention that this is a dislocated worker program. It's a unique program. It's not the federal side. We get the federal funding from the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. So I wanted to check in with you. I know many individuals are asking, how will this work? Because the competitive side and the other pieces that we put together here from the House perspective, a little bit of a difference with the recommendation from the governor's recommendation and the departments. I wanted to know, will this be something that we can all agree on to move forward the need for workforce development in the state?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a great question. And we've been following closely all the testimony in these committees from workforce organizations. You're right, many of whom have really unique and creative ideas about how to turn this economy around and help people find jobs. And, you know, we've always been of the belief that you can both foster and encourage and fund those kinds of innovative new approaches and invest in the stuff that year over year shows that it just plain works. And you don't have to have the two compete or say you need to choose one direction or the other. So one of the fundamental tenets of our recommendation, and I think it's similar to the House reforms, is simply that you should have a special bucket of funding that is focused on innovation grants, grants to organizations trying new things. And Senator Pratt has shared a thesis on this with me a while back that I really liked as kind of a descriptor of this, which is that you have an innovation bucket where new approaches are tried, and then a competitive grant bucket where it's much more metrics driven and driven by simply what are your outcomes in terms of placements and wages. And you kind of graduate up into that other bucket, which I thought was a nice kind of analogy of how to think about that. But, you know, we've got a great host of organizations across our state who do this work, who do it in community, in the languages, in the style, and in the needs that are relevant in those communities that we need to fund so that they can help workers find jobs. And, you know, we've got a dislocated worker program in the state that is in addition to the federal money, as you say, Representative, this is all sort of on top of what every state gets from a federal standpoint, that is a really huge value to our state. And we want to make sure we preserve the ability to make sure every single worker can get those services if they're fired from a job and need to look for a new one. We've just seen over time that the take-up rate for that program has significantly decreased. So there's some efficiencies in saying, look, let's not bottle up money for that portion of the program, but rather leverage it for uses in real time and make sure we preserve the ability to ensure every single dislocated worker gets the funding that they need. So we think we can do both with the amount of money that we have. And then to your point on performance, which I know Senator Pratt and his committee asked almost every nonprofit that came in front of them, which is a good question. You know, would you use pay for performance, or would pay for performance be a direction that you would go? We have a good pay for performance statute on the books in Minnesota. There are a number of nonprofits who take advantage of it. Basically, what it means is you get paid based on the number of job placements at a certain wage rate versus getting paid up front just to do the training and then let's see what happens. So it's a really interesting model. It doesn't work for every organization, to be clear. And I want to make sure we note that it's not perfect for everybody, in large part because it costs money to do the work up front. And if you don't have any money, then how do you do the work, right? So for a new organization or a smaller one, that's harder. But we're generally in favor of using performance to guide us. And so one of the big reform components of this is to say, what are we trying to achieve? Well, let's simplify. We're trying to achieve job placements at a good rate, a good wage rate, and a credential, right? Because a credential means you're not just getting that next job, but you got some foundation to sit on for the future. And I think by establishing that North Star of what we're trying to do, which we've done in these reforms, it just really clarifies what this whole system is about. It roots it in effectiveness and efficiency. And then I think equity is just a central concern of this whole fund. And it hasn't been the most equitable fund in the past. The fix for that in recent years has been to just focus on direct appropriations. We think we can do better for communities of color than that and spend a lot more on communities of color through this, tens of millions of dollars more. And so that's a core component of this too. So we're eager to do it. It's a reform that's been long needed. And it's not a particularly partisan one either, by the way. You know, and geographically, you know, the grants would go 50-50 greater Minnesota in the metro. So it's certainly something that is thought of statewide, not just, you know, for a particular part of Minnesota. So we're eager to do it. And I think, yeah, there's some differences between the House and the governor's approach, but we'll solve them. Like, that's, none of them are hugely untenable. And we think this is something that can be a win-win for all of us.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know we've been here since in the morning. Everyone is now, you know, immersed with a lot of information. I just wanted to conclude and thank Commissioner Grove and everyone. And we look forward to the next chapter of our conversation. We have a training tomorrow, so we will not have a session tomorrow, but and also on Saturday. So I wanted to defer to Chair Pratt on the next procedures that we will go through for the conference committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So we will convene at 9 a.m. on Monday. This time seems to work well for both the House and the Senate, and so we've roughly sketched out we've met, the House sketched it out and kind of reserved the time, and the Senate thought that was a pretty good idea. We are going to do a hybrid meeting again. We do have a larger room this time. We'll be in the Minnesota State Senate building, room 1100. So we'll have a more room for members. I thought it was great that we had as many members in attendance our last meeting and really led to that change. The goal here is to take public testimony about 2 minutes per person, just at a high level about the bill. As we dig in and work on amendments, we'll be taking, you know, potentially additional public testimony where we can get more in depth. But you know, we really want to hear from Minnesotans about what they think about the two bills. They, you know, both what they like and where their concerns are. This is, you know, hopefully as we've talked about today, this is crucial for the recovery of our state economy right now and getting people back to work. And, you know, as I said on the Senate floor, and I know I share with my colleagues, we all want to get Minnesotans back to work. So, Mr. Chair, we'll plan on 9 o'clock Monday with public testimony. Anyone who wants to testify can email andrew.eilers@senate.mn and get on the list, and we'll be taking testimony from 9 to noon. Any testimony that we don't get to, we'll have to work with Chair Knorr on his meeting on Tuesday, whether we want to continue. And certainly any member of the public can submit testimony in writing to all the conference committee members, either through Chair Knorr's committee administrator or the Senate committee administrator. And we'll make sure that we get those distributed to all the members as well. And I'll hand it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. Any questions from members? Seeing none, we are now adjourned. Thank you so much for joining us, all of you.